Blue Mars, Cassette 21. At this point, Underhill was a kind of museum, kept in the state it had been in 2138, the last year it had been a functioning peace stop. This meant that it didn't look exactly as it had in the years of their occupancy, but the older parts were all still there, so the changes since wouldn't affect their project much, Sachs judged. After his arrival with several others, he took a walk around to see, and there the old buildings all were, the original four habitats, dropped whole from space, their junk heaps, Nadia's square of barrel vault chambers with their domed center, Hiroko's greenhouse framework, its enclosing bubble gone, Nadia's trench arcade off to the northwest, Chernobyl, the salt pyramids, and finally, the alchemist. Quarter, where Sachs ended his walk, wandering around in the warren of buildings and pipes, trying to ready himself for the next day's experience. Trying for an open mind. Already his memory was seething, as if trying to prove that it needed no help to do its work. Here among these buildings he had first witnessed the transformative power of technology over the blank materiality of nature. They had started with just rocks and gases, really, and from that they had extracted and purified and transformed and recombined and shaped in so many different ways that no one person could keep good track of them all, nor even imagine their effect. So he had seen, but he hadn't understood. And they had acted perpetually in ignorance of their true powers, and with, perhaps as a result, very little sense of what they were trying for. But there in the alchemist's quarter, he hadn't been able to see that. He had been so sure that the world made green would be a fine place. Now here he stood in the open, head free under a blue sky in the heat of 2nd August, looking around and trying to think, to remember. It was hard to direct the memory. Things simply occurred to him. The objects in the old part of town felt distinctly familiar, as in the word's root meaning, of the family. Even the individual red stones and boulders around the settlement, and all the bumps and hollows in view, were perfectly familiar, all still in their proper places on the compass flower. Prospects for the experiment seemed very good to Sachs. They were in their place, in their context, situated, oriented. At home. He returned to the square of barrel vaults where they were going to stay. Some cars had driven in during his walk, and some little excursion trains were parked on the sidings next to the piste. People were arriving. There were Maya and Nadia hugging Tasha and Andrea, who had arrived together. Their voices rang in the air like a Russian opera, like recitative on the edge of bursting into song. Of the 101 they had begun with, there were only 14 of them going to show up. Sachs, Anne, Maya, Nadia, Desmond, Ursula, Marina, Vasily, George, Edvard, Roger, Mary, Dmitri, Andrea. Not so many, but it was every one of them still alive and in contact with the world. All the rest were dead or missing. If Hiroko and the other 7 of the 100 who had disappeared with her were still alive, they had sent no word. Perhaps they would show up unannounced, as they had at John's first festival on Olympus. Perhaps not. So they were 14. Thus reduced, Underhill seemed underoccupied. Though all of it was theirs to spread out in, they yet crowded together into the south wing of the barrel vaults. Nevertheless, the emptiness of the rest of it was palpable. It was as if the place itself was an image of their failing memories, with their lost labs and lost lands and lost companions. Every single one of them was suffering from memory losses and disorders of one sort or another. Between them, they had experienced almost all the problems in mentation mentioned in the literature, as far as Sachs could tell, and a good bit of their conversation was taken up in comparative symptomatology, in the recounting of various terrifying and or sublime experiences that had afflicted them in the last decade. It made them jocular and somber by turns as they milled around that evening in the little barrel vault kitchen in the southwest corner, with its high window looking out onto the floor of the central greenhouse, still under its thick glass dome in its muted light. They ate a picnic dinner brought in coolers, talking, catching up, then spreading along the south wing, preparing the upstairs bedrooms for an uneasy night. They stayed up as late as they could, talking and talking, but eventually they gave up in ones and twos and tried to sleep. Several times that night, Sax woke from dreams and heard people stumbling down to the bathrooms or whispering conversations in the kitchen or muttering to themselves in the troubled sleep of the aged. Each time he managed to slip back under again into a light, dream-filled sleep of his own. Finally, morning came. They were up at dawn. In the horizontal light, they ate a quick breakfast, fruit and croissants, then bread and coffee. Long shadows cast west from every rock and hillock. So familiar. Then they were ready. There was nothing else to do. There was a kind of collective deep breath, uneasy laughter, an inability to meet the other's eyes. Maya, however, was still refusing to take the treatment. She was unswayed by every argument they tried. "I won't," she had said over and over the night before. "You'll need a keeper in any case, in case you go crazy. I'll do that." Sax had thought she would change her mind, that she was just being Maya. Now he stood before her, baffled. "I thought you were having the worst memory troubles of all."
"Perhaps."
"So it would make sense to try this treatment. Michelle gave you lots of different drugs for mental trouble."
"I don't want to," she said, looking him in the eye. He sighed.
"I don't understand you, Maya."
"I know."
And she went into the old med clinic in the corner and took on her role as their keeper for the day. Everything in there was ready, and she called them in one by one and took up little ultrasound injectors and put them to their necks, and with a little click hiss administered one part of the drug package and gave them the pills that contained the rest of it, and then helped them insert the earplugs that were custom designed for each of them to broadcast the silent electromagnetic waves. In the kitchen, they waited for everyone to finish their preparations in a nervous silence. When they were all done, Maya ushered them to the door and guided them outside. And they were off. Sax saw and felt an image. Bright lights. A feeling of his skull being crushed, choking, gasping, spitting. Chill air and his mother's voice, like an animal's yelp.
"Oh, oh, oh, oh!"
Then lying wet on her chest, cold. "Oh my." The hippocampus was one of several specific brain regions that had been very strongly stimulated by the treatment. This meant that his limbic system, spread under the hippocampus like a net under a walnut, was likewise stimulated, as if the nut were bouncing up and down on a trampoline of nerves, causing the trampoline to resonate, or even to jangle. Thus, Sax felt the start of what would no doubt be a flood of emotions, registering not any single emotion, he noted, but many at once, and at nearly the same intensity, and free of any cause. Joy, grief, love, hate, exhilaration, melancholy, hope, fear, generosity, jealousy, many of which, of course, didn't match with their opposite or with most of the others present in him. The result of this overcrowded mix, for Sax at any rate, sitting on a bench outside the barrel vault, breathing hard, was a kind of adrenalized, breath-stopping growth in his sensation of significance. A suffusion of meaning through everything. It was heartbreaking, or heart-filling, as if oceans of clouds were stuffed in his chest so that he could scarcely breathe, a kind of nostalgia to the nth power,
a fullness, even bliss, pure sublimity. Just sitting there, just the fact that they were alive. But all of it with a sharp edge of loss, with regret for lost time, with fear of death, fear of everything, grief for Michelle, for John, for all of them, really. This was so unlike Sax's usual calm, steady, one might even say phlegmatic state, that he was almost incapacitated. He couldn't move well, and for several minutes he bitterly regretted ever initiating any such experiment as this. It was very foolish, idiotically foolhardy. No doubt everyone would hate him forever. Stunned, nearly overwhelmed, he decided to try to walk to see if that would clear his head. He found he could walk. Push off the bench, stand, balance, walk, avoiding others who were wandering by in their own worlds, as oblivious to him as he was to them, everyone getting past each other like objects to be avoided. And then he was out in the open space of the Underhill environs, out in the chilly morning breeze, walking toward the salt pyramids under a strangely blue sky. He stopped and looked around, considered, grunted in surprise, came to a halt. Could not walk. For all of a sudden, he could remember everything. Not everything, everything. He couldn't recall what he had had for breakfast on 2 August 13 in 2029, for instance. That was in accord with experiments which suggested that daily habitual activities were not differentiated enough on entrainment to allow for individual recall. But as a class, in the late 2020s he had started his days back in the barrel vault at the southeast corner, where he had shared an upstairs bedroom with Hiroko, Evgenia, Raya, and Iwao. Experiments, incidents, conversations flickered in his mind as he saw that bedroom in his mind's eye. A node in time-space, vibrating a whole network of days. Raya's pretty back across the room as she washed under her arms. Things people said that hurt in their carelessness. Vlad talking about clipping jeans. He and Vlad had stood out here together on this very spot in their very first minute on Mars, looking around at everything without a word for each other, just absorbing the gravity and the pink of the sky and the close horizons, looking just as they look now, so many years later. Areological time, as slow and long as the great systolus itself. In the walkers, one had felt hollow. Chernobyl had required more concrete than could be cured in the thin, dry, cold air. Nadia had fixed it somehow. How? Heating it, that's right. Nadia had fixed a lot of things in those years. The barrel vaults, the manufactories, the arcade. Who would have suspected a person so quiet on the Ares would prove so competent and energetic? He hadn't remembered that Ares impression of her for ages. She had been so pained when Tatiana Durova was killed by a falling crane, it was a shock to them all except Michelle, who had been revealed as amazingly dissociated by the disaster, their first death. Would Nadia remember that now? Yes, she would if she thought about it. Nothing unique about Sax, or to be more accurate, if the treatment was working on him, it would work on all of them. There was Vasily, who had fought for Unoma in both revolutions. What was he remembering? He looked stricken, but it could have been rapture. Anything or everything. Very likely it was the everything emotion, the fullness, apparently one of the first effects of the treatment. Perhaps he was remembering Tatiana's death as well. Once Sax and Tatiana had gone out on a hike in Antarctica during their year there, and Tatiana had slipped on a loose boulder and sprained an ankle, and they had had to wait on Nussbaum Regal for a helicopter from McMurdo to lift them back to camp. He had forgotten that for years, and then Phyllis had reminded him of it the night she had had him arrested, and he had promptly forgotten it again until this very moment. 2 rehearsals in 200 years, But now it was back. The low sun, the cold, the beauty of the dry valleys, Phyllis's jealousy of Tatiana's great dark beauty. That their beauty should die first, it was like a sign, a primal curse, Mars as Pluto, planet of fear and dread. And now that day in Antarctica, the two women long dead. He was the only carrier of that day so precious. Without him, it would be gone. Ah, yes. What one could remember was precisely the part of the past that one had felt the most. The events spiked by emotion above a certain threshold. The great joys, the great crises, the great disasters, and the small ones as well. He had been cut from the 7th grade basketball team, had cried alone after reading the list, at a drinking fountain at the far edge of the school, thinking, "You will remember this forever," and, by God, he had. Great beauty. The first times one did things had that special charge. First love. Who had that been, though? A blank. Back there in Boulder. A face. Some friend of a friend. But that wasn't love. And he couldn't recall her name. No. Now he was thinking of Anne Claiborne, standing before him, looking at him closely, sometime long ago. What had he been trying to recall? The rush of thought was so dense and rapid, he wouldn't be able to remember some of this remembering, he was pretty sure. A paradox, but only one of many caused by the single thread of consciousness in the huge field of the mind. 10^43, the matrix in which all Big Bangs flowered. Inside, the skull was a universe as vast as the one outside. Anne. He had taken a walk with her in Antarctica as well. She was strong. Curious, during the walk across Olympus Mons Caldera, he had never once remembered this walk across Wright Valley in Antarctica, despite the similarities, a walk during which they had argued so earnestly over the fate of Mars, and he had wanted so much to take her hand, or for her to take his. Why, he had had a kind of crush on her. And him in his lab rat mode, having never before risen to such feelings, now stifled for no better reason than shyness. She had looked at him curiously, but hadn't understood his import, only wondered that he should stammer so. He had stammered a fair bit when a boy. It was a biochemical problem apparently solved by puberty, but it occasionally came back when he was nervous. Anne. He saw her face as he argued with her on the Ares, in Underhill, in Dorsa Brevia, in the warehouse on Pavonis. Why always this assault on a woman he had been attracted to? Why? She was so strong. And yet he had seen her so depressed that she lay helplessly on the floor in that boulder car for many days as her red Mars died. Just lay there. But then she had pried herself off the floor and gone on. She had stopped Maya from yelling at him. She had helped bury her partner, Simon. She had done all these things, and never, never, never had Sax been anything but a burden to her. Part of her pain, that was what he was for her. Angry with her in zygote or gamete. Gamete. Both, really. Her face so drawn. And then he hadn't seen her for 20 years. And then later, after he had forced the longevity treatment on her, he hadn't seen her for 30 years. All that time wasted. If they lived for 1,000 years, it wouldn't be long enough to justify such waste. Wandering in the alchemist's quarter, he came on Vasily again, sitting in the dust with the tears running down his face. The two of them had botched the Underhill algae experiment together, right there inside this very building. But Sax doubted very much that this was what Vasily was crying about. Something from the many years he had worked for Unoma, perhaps, or something else, No way to know. Well, he could ask. But wandering around Underhill, seeing faces, and then remembering in a rush everything about them that one knew, was not a situation conducive to follow-up inquiries. No, walk on. Leave Vasily to his own past. Sax didn't want to know what Vasily regretted. Besides, halfway to the horizon to the north, the figure was striding away alone. Am. Odd to see her head free of a helmet, white hair coursing back in the wind. It was enough to stop the flow of memories. But then he had seen her that way before, in Wright Valley. Yes, her hair light then, too. Dishwater blonde, they called that color, not very generously. So dangerous to develop any bond under the watchful eyes of the psychologists. They were there on business, under pressure. There was no room for personal relations, which were dangerous indeed, as Natasha and Sergei had proved. But still, it happened. Vlad and Ursula became a couple, solid, stable. And same with Hiroko and Awao, Nadia and Arkady. But the danger, the risk. Anne had looked at him across the lab table, eating lunch, and there was something in her eye, some regard. He didn't know. He couldn't read people. They were all such mysteries. The day he got his letter of acceptance, selection to the first 100, he had felt so sad. Why was that? No way of knowing. But now he saw that letter in the fax box, the maple tree outside the window. He had called Anne to see if she had been included. She had. A bit of a surprise. Her, such a loner. But he had been a bit happier. But still, sad. The maple had been red-leafed. Autumn in Princeton, traditionally a melancholy time, but that hadn't been it. Not at all. Just sad. As if accomplishment were nothing but a certain number of the body's 3 billion heartbeats passed, and now it was 10 billion and counting. No, there was no explanation. People were mysteries. So when Anne had said, "Do you want to hike out to Lookout Point?" in that Dry Valley lab, he had agreed instantly, without a stammer, and without really arranging to. They had walked out separately. She had left the camp and hiked out to Lookout Point, and he had followed. And out there, oh yes, looking down at the cluster of huts and the greenhouse dome, a kind of proto-Underhill, he had taken her gloved hand in his as they sat side by side, arguing over terraforming in a perfectly friendly way, no stakes involved. And she had pulled her hand away as if shocked, and shuddered. It was very cold, for Terra, anyway. And he had stammered just as badly as he had after his stroke. A limbic hemorrhage, killing on the spot certain elements, certain hopes, yearnings. Love dead. And he had harried her ever since. Not that these events functioned as proper causal explanations, no matter what Michel would have said. But the Antarctic cold of that walk back to the base, even in the eidetic clarity of his current power of recollection, he couldn't see much of that walk, distracted. Why? Why had he repelled her so? Little man. White lab coat. There was no reason. But it had happened, and left its mark forever, and even Michel had never known. Repression. Thinking of Michel made him think of Maya. Anne was on the horizon now. He would never catch her. He wasn't sure he wanted to at that moment, still stunned by this so surprising, so painful memory. He went looking for Maya. Past where Arkady had laughed at their tawdriness when he came down from Phobos, past Hiroko's greenhouse, where she had seduced him with her impersonal friendliness, like primates on the savannah, the alpha female grabbing one male among the others, an alpha, a beta, or that class of could-be-alpha but not interested, which struck him as the only decent way to behave. Past the trailer park, where they had all slept on the floor together, a family, with Desmond in a closet somewhere. Desmond had promised to show them how he had lived then, all his hiding places, jumble of Desmond images, the flight over the burning canal, then the flight over burning Casey, the fear in Casey as the security people strapped him in to their insane device. That had been the end of Saxifrage Russell. Now he was something else, and Anne was counter-Anne, also the third woman that was neither Anne nor counter-Anne. He could perhaps speak to her on that basis, as two strangers meeting, rather than the two who had met in the Antarctic. Maya was sitting in the barrel vault kitchen, waiting for a big teapot to boil. She was making tea for them.
Maya, said Sax, feeling the words like pebbles in his mouth. You should try it. It's not so bad.
She shook her head. I remember everything that I want to. Even now, without your drugs, even now when I hardly remember anything, I still remember more than you ever will. I don't want any more than that. It was possible that minute quantities of the drugs had gotten into the air and thus onto her skin, giving her a small fraction of the hyper-emotional experience, or perhaps this was just her ordinary state. Why shouldn't now be enough? She was saying. I don't want my past back. I don't want it. I can't bear it.
Maybe later, Sax said.
What could one say to her? She had been like this in Underhill as well, unpredictable, moody. It was amazing what eccentrics had been selected to the first 100. But what choice had the selection committee had? People were all like that, unless they were stupid. And they hadn't sent stupid people to Mars, or not at first, or not too many. And even the dull-witted had their complexities. Maybe, she said now, and patted his head and took the teapot off the burner. Maybe not. I remember too much as it is.
Frank, Sax said.
Of course. Frank, John, they're all there. She stabbed her chest with a thumb. It hurts enough. I don't need more.
Ah.
He walked back outside, feeling stuffed, uncertain of anything, off balance. Limbic system vibrating madly under the impact of his whole life, under the impact of Maya, so beautiful and damned. How he wished her happy, but what could one do? Maya lived her unhappiness to the full. It made her happy, one might say. Or complete. Perhaps she felt this acutely uncomfortable emotional overfullness all the time. Wow! So much easier to be phlegmatic. And yet she was so alive. The way she had flailed them onward out of the chaos, south to the refuge in Zygote, such strength. All these strong women. Actually, to face up to life's awfulness, awfulness, to face it and feel it without denial, without defenses, just admit it and carry on. John, Frank, Arcadi, even Michelle, they had all had their great optimism, pessimism, idealism, their mythologies to mask the pain of existence, all their various sciences, and still they were dead, killed off one way or another, leaving Nadia and Maya and Anne to carry on and carry on. No doubt he was a lucky man to have such tough sisters. Even Phyllis, yes, somehow, with the toughness of the stupid, making her way pretty well, at least, fairly well, at least making it for a while, never giving up, never admitting anything. She had protested his torture. Spencer had told him so. Spencer and all their hours of aerodynamics together, telling him over too many whiskies how she had gone to the security chief in Casay and demanded his release, his decent treatment, even after he had knocked her cold, almost killed her with nitrous oxide, lied to her in her own bed. She had forgiven him, apparently. And Spencer had never forgiven Maya for killing her, though he pretended he had. And Sachs had forgiven her, even though for years he had acted as if he hadn't, to get some kind of hold on her. Ah, the strange recombinant tangle they had made of their lives, result of the overextension, or perhaps it was that way in every village, always. But so much sadness and betrayal. Perhaps memory was triggered by loss, as everything was inevitably lost. But what about joy? He tried to remember. Could one cast back by emotional category? Interesting idea. Was that possible? Walking through the halls of the terraforming conference, for instance, and seeing the poster board that estimated the heat contribution of the Russell cocktail at 12 kelvins? Waking up in Eckes Overlook and seeing that the great storm was gone, the pink sky radiant with sunlight, seeing the faces on the train as they slid out of Libya station, being kissed in the ear by Hiroko in the baths one winter day in Zygote when it was evening all afternoon. Hiroko! He had been huddling in the cold, quite vexed, to think he would be killed by a storm just when things were getting interesting, trying to work out how he might call his car to him, as it seemed he wouldn't be able to get to it. And then there she had appeared out of the snow, a short figure in a rust-red spacesuit, bright in the white storm of wind and horizontal snow, the wind so loud that even the intercom mic in his helmet was no more than a whisper. Hiroko? He cried as he saw her face through the slush-smeared faceplate. And she said, "Yes," and pulled him up by the wrist, helped him up. That hand on his wrist, he felt it. And up he came, like Veritas itself, the green force pouring through him, through the white noise, the white static sleeting by, her grip warm and hard, as full as the plenum itself. Yes! Hiroko had been there. She had led him back to the car, had saved his life, had then disappeared again, and no matter how certain Desmond was of her death in Sabashii, no matter how convincing his arguments were, no matter how often second climbers had been hallucinated by solo climbers in distress, Sachs knew better because of that hand on his wrist, that visitation in the snow. Hiroko herself in the hard, compact flesh, as real as rock, alive. So that he could rest in that knowledge. He could know something. In the inexplicable seeping of the unexplainable into everything, he could rest in that known fact. Hiroko lived. Start with that and go on. Build on it. The axiom of a lifetime of joy. Perhaps even convince Desmond of it. Give him that peace. He was back outside looking for the coyote. Not an easy task, ever. What did Desmond recall of Underhill? Hiding, whispers, the lost farm crew, then the lost colony, slipping away with them. Out there, driving around Mars in disguised boulders, being loved by Hiroko, flying over the night surface in a stealth plane, playing the demimonde, knitting the underground together. Sachs could almost remember it himself. It was so vivid to him. Telepathic transfer of all their stories to all of them. 100 squared in the square of barrel vaults. No, that would be too much. Just the imagination of someone else's reality was stunning enough, was all the telepathy one required or could handle. But where had Desmond gone?
hopeless. One could never find Coyote. One only waited for him to find you. He would show up when he chose. For now, out northwest of the pyramids and the alchemist's quarter, there was a very ancient lander skeleton, probably from the original pre-landing equipment drop, its metal stripped of paint and encrusted with salt. The beginning of their hopes, now a skeleton of old metal. Nothing, really. Hiroko had helped him unload this one. Back into the alchemist's quarter, all the machines in the old buildings shut down, hopelessly outdated, even the very clever Sabatier processor. He had enjoyed watching that thing work. Nadia had fixed it one day when everyone else was baffled. Little round woman, humming some tune in a world of her own, communing with machinery, back when machines could be understood. Thank God for Nadia. The anchor holding them all to reality, the one they could always count on. He wanted to give her a hug, this most beloved sister of his, who it appeared was over there in the vehicle yard trying to get a museum exhibit bulldozer to run. But there on the horizon was a figure walking westward over a knoll. Anne. Had she been circling the horizon, walking and walking? He ran out toward her, stumbling just as he would have in the first week. He caught up with her slowly, gasping.
Anne? Anne?
She turned, and he saw the instinctive fear on her face, as on the face of a hunted animal. He was a creature to run from. This was what he had been to her.
I made mistakes, he said as he stopped before her.
They could speak in the open air, in the air he had made over her objection, though it was still thin enough to make one gasp.
I didn't see the beauty until it was too late. I'm sorry, sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Oh, he had tried to say it before, in Michelle's car when the deluge poured, in Zygote, in Tempe Terra. Never had it worked. Anne and Mars, all intertwined. And yet he had no apology to make to Mars. Every sunset was beautiful. The sky's color a different wash tint every minute of every day. Blue sign of their power and their responsibility. Their place in the cosmos and their power within it. So small and yet so important. They had brought life to Mars. And it was good, he was sure of that. For the years of missionary fervor, the pressure applied to make her agree, the hunt for the wild beast of her refusal to kill it dead. Sorry for that. So sorry. His face wet with tears, and she stared at him so. Just precisely as she had on that cold rock in Antarctica, in that first refusal, which had all come back and rested inside him now. His past.
Do you remember?
He said to her curiously, shunted onto that new train of thought.
We walked out to Lookout Point together. I mean, one after the next. But to meet, to talk in private. We went out separately. I mean, you know how it was then. That Russian couple had fought and been sent home. We all hid everything we could from the selection people.
He laughed, choking somewhat at the image of their deeply irrational beginnings. So apt. And everything since played out so in keeping with such a beginning. They had come out to Mars and replayed everything just as it had always been played before. It was nothing but trait recurrence, pattern repetition.
We sat there, and I thought we were getting on, and I took your hand, but you pulled it away. You didn't like it. I felt bad. We went back separately and didn't talk again like that, in that way. Not ever.
And then I hounded you through all this, I guess, and I thought it was because of the He waved at the blue sky.
I remember, she said.
She was looking cross-eyed at him. He felt the shock of it. One didn't get to do this. One never got to say to the lost love of one's youth, I remember. It still hurts. And yet there she stood, looking at his face, amazed.
Yes,
she said.
But that wasn't what happened, she said, frowning. It was me. I mean, I put my hand on your shoulder. I liked you. It seemed like we might become... But you jumped.
Ha! Huh. You jumped like I had shocked you with a cattle prod. Static electricity was bad down there, but still... Sharp laugh.
No. It was you. You didn't... It wasn't your kind of thing, I figured. And it wasn't mine, either. In a way, it should have worked, just because of that. But it didn't. And then I forgot about it.
No, Sack said. He shook his head in a primitive attempt to recast his thought, to re-remember. He could still see in his mental theater that awkward instant at Lookout Point, the whole thing clear, almost word for word, move for move. It's a net gain in order, he had said, trying to explain the purpose of science. And she had said, for that you would destroy the entire face of a planet. He remembered it. But there was that look on Anne's face as she recalled the incident, that look of someone in full possession of a moment of her past, alive with the upwelling. Clearly she remembered it too, and yet remembered something different than he had. One of them had to be wrong, didn't they? Didn't they? Could we really, he said, and had to stop and try again. Could we really have been two such maladroit people as to both go out, intending to reveal ourselves? Anne laughed.
And both go away feeling rebuffed? By the other?
She laughed again.
Why, sure.
He laughed as well. They turned their faces to the sky and laughed. But then Sax shook his head, rueful to the point of agony. Whatever had happened, well, no way of knowing now. Even with his memory upwelling like an artesian fountain, like one of the cataclysmic outbreak floods themselves, there was still no way to be sure what had really happened, which gave him a sudden chill. If he couldn't trust these upwelling memories to be true, if one so crucial as this one was now cast in doubt, what then of the others? What about Hiroko out there in the storm, leading him to his car, hand on his wrist? Could that too be... No, that hand on his wrist. But Anne's hand had jerked away from him. A somatic memory just as solidly real, just as physical, a kinetic event remembered in his body, in the pattern of cells for as long as he should live. That one had to be true. They both had to be true.
This ends side one of cassette 21. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.